episode 23. Here we go. Today's guest is Becky Gardenhire, the co-head of WME Nashville. Becky's one of those people that when you first move to town, you kind of hear her name everywhere. Like, everybody wants to meet with her, or everybody's like talking about her. And, you know, it makes sense. I mean, she's so involved in the industry. Her list of clients is insane. And this was actually one of the first times we interacted, and it was such a thrill. It was so much fun talking with her. This is a really great episode. What I love about this episode is that we really talk about the music industry today during COVID, especially the touring industry, how to engage fans during this time, how to stay afloat. There is so much information in here that I love. Can't wait for you guys to hear it. I'm not gonna give too much away. Don't worry about it. I'll stop talking. Let's dive in.
Well, it's funny because I was listening to a podcast you did earlier this year with Aiba, and it was funny because you and Pam were so enthusiastic about the year and so excited, and it was like breaking my heart because I was like, that's like nobody knows what's coming. It was,
I know. Wild. Isn't that interesting to look back? I mean, it's funny you say that. I looked back at my own personal calendar, right? And I looked back in like January, February, and March, and like January, February, all the shows that I like had penciled in and I went to go see, cover clients, and what I was looking. And I remember I was kind of dreading April because it was going to be a really busy month for me. I was going to have to go out like almost every weekend. And now here we are where, I mean, I haven't been to a show in so long. I mean, obviously I haven't even been to the airport as much, right? I went to the airport, my family and I, we got away Labor Day weekend, and I don't know if you've been to the Nashville airport, how much it's changed. They've been doing this construction. It's totally different. And I was like, oh my gosh, like I was coming to the airport, you know, three times a month at least. And the fact that I haven't been, and like how fast it's changed, was crazy.
The two big things are, you know, B&A carpet gone, of course, yep. Devastating. Yep. And yep. Then have they fixed the Starbucks problem yet? Have they added more?
No, but so the D terminal is open. And I think there's supposed to be a Starbucks in that new terminal, but it wasn't open when we were there, at least. Because we actually flew out of the D terminal, but we came back through the normal C terminal. But yeah, it's interesting.
I'm excited to see it.
Garages, yeah,
ordered my B&A doormat, which is at which I can't wait to use and reminisce.
Oh, Brandon, the B&A carpet is like the ugliest and worst, but it became a thing. So like, it's now a souvenir since they got rid of it too. It's so funny. It became like a social hashtag B&A carpet.
Every time you land at the airport, celebrities, everyone, they take a photo, they tag B&A carpet. It's like, yeah. It's a cult following. We're very emotionally attached to our carpet at the airport, us Nashvillians. Unbelievable. But, okay, wait. So the big question on everyone's mind, not to just dive right in, but okay, so when are concerts coming back? What's it gonna take? How are we gonna get back into these rooms?
That's a great question. And it's funny because, you know, the industry has so many different varying opinions. I mean, just like all of us are, you know, none of us have a crystal ball. So none of us really know. We're all trying to do our best and plan and be prepared for literally all the different situations, right? I mean, I know most agents have a plan A, plan B, plan C, plan B, maybe even plan E for all the different routing and versions of the tour. You know, it's like, can it start? How early can it start? And then if it can't start, then can we keep pushing it back and you keep, you know, moving it back by a couple months or, so that's really tricky. I mean, I think on a big scale, arenas, amphitheaters, specifically amphitheaters, I'm feeling optimistic that we'll be able to do some stuff by summer, but like more midsummer. But you know, I say that, and then I can talk to Live Nation, and someone at Live Nation can maybe say, oh, maybe not, or maybe in certain markets, because that's the other situation right now is every state has their own, you know, laws, right? So I was literally on the phone this morning with one of the venues, like arena manager groups, and he's, you know, part of a 90 different arenas in this one management group for the arenas. And he was like, so within those 90 arenas, he's like, we have some states that technically are open and could do 100% capacity show right now because those states don't have specific laws that are binding them from doing that. But then you can go to, you know, two states from the map, if you will, routing purposes, and you can't. You can only do a 40% capacity in that state. You know, like, so in Wisconsin, you know, they're going to have different rules than they do in the Dakotas. So normally you would route, you know, through Milwaukee, over to Minneapolis, over to Fargo, and all three of those states have different regulations and restrictions. So you can't do the same type of show necessarily in each arena. Yeah, so that makes it really hard, obviously, to just be full open and do that kind of a size of room. I think, you know, the smaller rooms, the clubs, you know, theaters, certainly might have the ability to open up faster. The problem for them is the economic structure, right? So like even, you know, in Nashville, you know, Chris Cobb at the Exit Inn or Ron over at Third Lindsley, like for them to open up, whether they're having 10% capacity versus 100% capacity, their overhead costs are still the same, right? And that's right. The same for an arena too, but like it's hard to, at that small level and with those small of margins for a club to be able to open up without being able to do a big majority of your capacity, it's just really hard to open. So they've got to be at a place where they can have probably safely 70 to 80% capacity in their rooms. Otherwise they can't do it. And I think the liability is another big factor. So if we can figure out, and I'm not a lawyer, never was, don't ever want to be, but like hearing all the liability conversations as far as where the liability really could fall, and it cannot even be proven as far as, okay, you have a show, if there was an outbreak, can you trace it? Not really, but then can they still sue you? Yeah, so do you want to take that risk to be in this legal action? You know, that's kind of the big problem right now too. I know that's been a conversation that came up recently. I know with like the NEVA group and other people who were really lobbying for like the Restart and Save Our Stages Acts is like, can we talk about the liability issues too? Because if that can really be discussed on a congressional level, that will give a lot of, you know, events and venues and, you know, everything from sports to concerts, some more relief on just how that'll actually play out, you know? But I think the state of Arkansas, I could be wrong on this, the state of Arkansas, I feel like a couple, like maybe in July, the governor like made a law, I had a policy that was like, you can't come back and sue any public space for COVID. So he took away the liability issue. I don't know if that's, you know, I have to look that up. I remember seeing an article about that. And so I could be wrong on that. You might want to fact check me.
We'll look it up. Is there a world where we go back to normal in the concert world without a vaccine? Is that what it's really going to take for us to fully go back to normal, whatever that's going to be?
I mean, I think the vaccine is definitely part of the solution, yes. Is it going to be the only solution? I don't know, because right, there's still going to be people who won't take vaccines. You know, there's the anti-vaxxers in general. Have you seen the, I think it's Abbott, Abbott Manufacturing or Abbott Industries that has the saliva test that's like $5?
Yep.
If those things come to market too, right, where then all of a sudden you can prove that you know, tested literally before you came to the concert or maybe even on site and it's negative, you know, that may be another solution to kind of open up concerts faster. Antibody testing. I know we talked with a Vanderbilt doctor recently. He came into one of our staff meetings, which was super awesome, and talked about, you know, those types of solutions. So I think the vaccine is certainly a big part of it, but I don't know if it's the only part of it. And quite honestly, I'm hoping and I'm optimistic that all of our industry colleagues and peers, there's so many great minds out there that we're going to have to be resourceful and come up with solutions. And we're not just waiting around on the vaccine, you know? I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see how politics play into this, because that has been playing into this for a while now, right? So that is going to shift and change things. I don't know how yet, because none of us know who's going to win or how the Senate seats will change, but that will happen, so, right? There's going to be change shifting one way or the other, and then how that impacts the rest of the policies going forward, so.
Absolutely. Okay, so you're like the artist development queen of Nashville. I'm curious, is now a good time to be a developing artist? One of your artists, I mean, I'm seeing your artists do amazing things, like Tennille Towns took over the Ryman for her charity show, which was amazing to watch. How do you keep fans engaged? And you know, some of your artists, it feels like, have such amazing traction right now, like Tenille Townes, Ingrid Andress. How do you keep that momentum going and make sure everyone's engaged in terms of their fans when they're not out on the road seeing them face to face?
That has been so challenging for every artist, like you said. I mean, and going back to what you're saying, like thinking like in October, you have this year planned out for some of these artists and you're like, oh, they're on this tour and they have this going on and they're releasing this album and we have all these things lined up around the album. And then it all obviously couldn't happen. I mean, it's obviously was really hard to pivot and change. But to your point, like each artist has to figure out a way to really keep engaging with their fans. And that's really, really case sensitive and dependent on each artist and what their fan base is, right? Because there's some fans who are really engaged already online and virally and, you know, following you socially. And then there's some fans who are only about the music and just want to see you play live. You know, so I think that's really tricky too, because like there can be some really great live acts where you can try to do as many things online socially or via a virtual show and it may not have the same impact. So, I mean, I know we've been really specific about let's be strategic based on you, like you as the artist, your fan base, how have you always engaged with them in the past? So how do we amplify that and maximize it now? Is it doing more of a VIP kind of meet and greet type of engagement? Is it doing more releases that are like, I'm releasing a new video and let's, you know, do something online together to celebrate that? Is it, like you said, the charity event and doing that live from a cool venue? And you know, there's a ton of new virtual streaming platforms out there, which are great. And there's some that are better than others, not in like, they're all great, but like some can be used differently by each artist. So if an artist really wants to have that one-on-one fan engagement during the show, you know, a Zoom or a Topeka or all of those platforms that have that capability are better than some of the other ones who are more like an Instagram Live. You know, I mean, Instagram Live and Facebook Live are great platforms, but you don't have a lot of that. You can't see the artist. We did a really cool thing with Access, which kind of created a very specific type of artist virtual venue platform where the artist could see each person. And I think that was helpful for at least the artists that we did it with, because they really wanted that connection with the fans and see them singing along and seeing them like, oh my gosh, this is my favorite song, versus just playing into your phone and it's going out there at Instagram Live and you just see the hearts bubbling up, you know. But each artist is different. So that's the big thing with artist development right now, is you really kind of have to focus in on each artist specifically and how they can maximize this time. I've been calling this year a gap year for some people. You know, I'm like, this
except
is
you can't
year.
Travel Europe or whatever.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, you're not going to like Europe backpacking like you would have in your gap year, but you can be doing a lot of different things that you normally wouldn't have time to do, you know?
So for someone like Tenille or Ingrid Andress, like, you know, they're a couple steps ahead, but if you're a couple steps behind on your development as an artist,
yeah,
is now an exciting, because it feels like there's less distractions and you can really work on your sound, your craft. Are you seeing is now an exciting time if you're a real developing artist, or, and then a couple, you know, it feels like we'll be in clubs before we're in arenas, you know, then you could go tour clubs. Is now sort of a unique, interesting time to be a developing artist?
So this is my opinion only, but I personally think it's almost a blessing, because I feel like when things were normal, there's a rat race, right? As a new developing artist, you're like, oh my gosh, I need to write. I'm gonna go shop and get a label. I need a publishing, or blah, blah, blah. Like, you're trying to constantly stay ahead.
Totally.
But like, not that labels and publishers, they're obviously still signing artists just like we are, but like, there's no rat race because you can't get out and do much. So I think it's actually given them a little bit more time to really hone in on who you are as an artist, who your song, you know, keep writing, keep developing your sound, you know. And I know there's a lot of different types of writing going on, whether it's Zoom writes or a few in-person writes, but it's like finding, you know, the different rooms that you're really creative in, virtual or real rooms, whatever they are. Because I feel like that's always been part of the process with development, that it gets rushed. And it gets rushed because people feel like they need to be in a hurry. And I think this has slowed everyone down, whether that's a good or a bad thing, I don't know yet, but I've been kind of saying, and I'm a normally optimistic person anyway, so I'm telling some of those young artists that I work with, like, take advantage of this, because you aren't feeling like you have to go out. I mean, especially on the agency side, they'll come to us and be like, I feel like I need to go out and start working. And I'll be like, why? And we always ask that, why? Not, there may be reasons you should, but oftentimes there's reasons to just wait it out a little bit longer, because like you still need to maybe develop a few things before you get out on the road. It's obviously super costly to get out on the road. And so now that there's no like feeling or temptation that they have to get out on the road, they don't have to, like, that's not a distraction for them. They can just worry about like, let's keep putting out music or working on music, or if we're going to put out music, really have a solid marketing plan behind it. So I don't know. I mean, that's my opinion. Like I said, I think touring is still obviously one of the most lucrative parts of your career as an artist, but it's also one of the hardest, right? So it is really costly. And so it's really hard to get it going and really develop it. And if you can really take this time now to just focus on the music and your branding and who you as an artist are, I think that's a blessing to really take advantage of that time.
Absolutely. I love your quote that I hear you say often, which is, you know, the importance of sitting at the table and actually being at the table. Not to take that quote too literally, but when we're all on Zoom and there is no table, how do you encourage, you know, younger people in the office, or, you know, how has that changed, or how do you make sure that you're still at the table, digitally in the time of COVID?
Well, that's a good question. Cause it's funny. Cause like you can set up these Zoom meetings and it's the same, like you said, if you're sitting around a table in person versus on a Zoom, it's like, you don't want to be the box on a Zoom that no one ever, like, oh, you forgot that person was there and you had to like scroll past, or they've been there the whole time and you don't even know what they mean or what they, so it's, I feel like you want to have something to contribute to a meeting and sit at the table and be a part of that conversation without, you know, kind of bringing something up just to bring something up. Like I hate the people who just want to hear themselves talk and they just bring things up and you're like, I'm not really sure why you even brought that up. But preparation is like my biggest, like, I say that all the time to like when I talk to students, or just always be prepared. So like if you're going into a meeting, like you obviously prepped for this interview. And so it's like, you know that you have something to ask because you prepped for it. And so you're ready for it. And even if the conversation goes a different way, if you've done the prep work, you're going to figure out a way to ask your question or find or contribute to that meeting in a way that's impactful and makes you look like you've done your work, you've done your homework. You know, I mean, I think that's, I'm actually shocked more times than not about people who don't do their prep work. And you can always tell. I can. I'm sure you can too, right?
Totally.
Anyway, so it's like sitting at the table, but like if you do your prep work, you can sit at the table or on a Zoom call and have a way to contribute without looking, you know, silly.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's go back. So you went to NYU, but are you from that area originally, or where are you from originally?
I'm originally from a little small town up in Northwest Ohio. I tell people Toledo because no one really knows my small town. I grew up on a farm. My dad's a farmer. He's still a farmer. My brother-in-law,
what kind of farm?
A vegetable farm. So if you drink V8 juice, which I don't, if you drink V8 juice, you're probably drinking my family's farm vegetables, because that's one of our biggest, we sell a lot of wholesale vegetables.
Holy
and
cow.
Campbell's is one of our biggest buyers, if you will. So yeah, my dad, my grandfather was farming, so it was just a family business. And
are
I
you
worked
a
on the farm.
Snob?
No, I mean, I probably should be, and I'm not. I'm very like, you know, granted, I can definitely tell, like, the green beans from our family farm are way better than any green beans you can buy in any grocery store. And you can just tell the difference. It's just so much better. Potatoes. I mean, it is when it's fresh, like it is a lot better, but I'm not that, like, believe me, I'm not going to farmers markets every Saturday. I probably should be, but I'm not.
Wait. So what was the first concert you ever went to?
Amy Grant at the Toledo Stranahan Theater in seventh grade. Well, I say that. That's what I always say is my first concert. I'll be honest. I saw concerts at Henry County Fair. That's my hometown fair. And it's a grandstand. I mean, it's not great. And I mean, there was a country concert every fair, so every August, but like, I didn't always count those because I wasn't really like, it wasn't a concert to me. You know what I mean? It was it's the grandstand where they do the demolition derby and the horse racing and the pig show. I mean, you know, so it didn't feel like it. So for me, a concert was like when I went to a real arena and it was like real.
And did you did you beg your parents to go to that show, like, or did they take you, like how did you end up in that room?
So my little friend, we were, you know, seventh grade, I guess, or I was sixth grade, she was seventh grade. That's what, it doesn't matter. Point is, she and I were both like Amy, this was like the baby stages. So this was Amy Grant's like height, and we were both big fans. And for her birthday, she was asking her mom to go and wanted to take three friends. I got to go. So yeah, I got lucky that I just got to go with a good friend of mine. And obviously my parents were like, okay, great. But it's, I mean, Toledo was a 45-ish, 50-minute drive. Like, there were no concert venues. That was the closest one. I would go to a lot of amphitheaters in Columbus, Ohio, which is 2.5 hours away. And they don't have an amphitheater anymore, but they used to have this awesome amphitheater called the Polaris. And I saw, Dave Matthews Band a million times. I saw the Dixie Chicks there. A ton of stuff. And that was when I was getting older, and I had an older sister. So when she was driving more, and then she went to Ohio State, which is in Columbus. So then I would go and like stay the weekend, and I'd go and see like 4 or 5 concerts in the summer that way. Detroit was another one that I could, like, was a closer market, but I honestly, we didn't go up to Detroit as much. So yeah, it was like either Toledo or Columbus is where I would see bigger concerts.
So,
and then I saw a bunch
of
fairs. Sorry, like, I keep interrupting you. But yeah,
no,
I saw a bunch of, like, you know, the fair circuit, which there's a lot in Ohio. You would just go see, like, I saw, Sawyer Brown played a fair not far from where I live. Like, it was the county over. And they would usually get bigger names. And so they got Sawyer Brown. And so it was like, oh, we're going to go see Sawyer Brown. But, you know, and they had a bigger
name. I love Sawyer Brown.
Oh, I love Sawyer Brown, too. Believe me, they're still, like, one of my go-tos. But it's funny because, like, I remember them coming to that fair, and it was like, oh, let's go see Sawyer Brown, because it was a bigger name for like the local fairs that are around us.
Unbelievable. Okay, wait. So at the Amy Grant, I mean, when you started at WME, you were originally in the film and television department, but did you think, like, Amy Grant, you're at that show and you're like, I'm going to work in the music industry? Like, did you feel that connected to concerts that early on?
So I didn't know you could have a job in the music industry. Right. Besides like being maybe a musician and artist. And obviously that I wasn't that, you know, so I just didn't know. I didn't really know enough about the music. I didn't know it really existed. I was fascinated with television specifically. And so I went to NYU and studied film and TV, went to LA to get in the television business, started in the TV department at William Morris out in LA. There was my high school offered a local TV station, and your junior and senior year, you could be part of like the programming of the local station. So I did a lot of sports filming. I was a commentator for girls and men's basketball, which probably is really bad if I go back and look at it as a junior in high school. I did morning announcements for our TV station. I mean, it was pretty bad, but I just started to like love being a part of like the TV side of it. And so that's what brought me to New York. That's what got me to LA. But then when I was in LA, I was an assistant, obviously, for an agent in the TV department. He was working on some projects with our Nashville office. And I was like, oh my gosh, we have a Nashville office? And they represent country music. And I grew up listening to country music. I've always been a country music fan. And so then they were like, oh, and I became friends with people via email, like the assistants. And they were like, oh, well, you can go see, you know, Pat Green at the House of Blues on Sunset. And I was like, what do you mean I can go? They're like, we can get you on the list. I'm like, what's a list? Like, I mean, I had no idea. So I started to like figure this out, and I was enjoying, I was going to country shows as a fan, and I was going to all these shows, and I was like, gosh, I feel like I'm being drawn, and this is what I like to do. And I was learning more about, you know, the music, the actual industry side of things, having had no idea. I wanted to make a trip to Nashville to visit. So I came to Nashville in 2000, it was either late 2001, early 2002. I think it was definitely more early 2002, and fell in love with it. And then I was like, I got to figure out a way to get to Nashville. Like, this is just my town, my people, the music, like all of it was me. I loved my time in LA, but I never felt like LA was going to be where I stayed long-term. So then I just was working through William Morris at the time about how to transfer.
Wait, hold on. How did you get the job of William Morris, first of all?
Good question. So back then, I mean, it was, I mean, obviously you had to go through all these steps, right? You had to go through the interview process and there was a typing test and all these, and I was doing that. And then, I mean, there was like 4 or 5 interviews. And in the meantime, I was networking.
How did you even get yourself in the room for the interviews?
Well, as I say, so I was networking with anyone I knew who could get me in the room. I mean, and it was everyone and anyone. I had interned when I was in college, I'd interned at a couple different places. And one of my, you know, supervisors that I was interning for had a connection. So she called her connection. Then I had coffee with that person's connection. Then I met someone else. I mean, I literally had like anyone I knew that had a connection at William Morris I was using and talking to. And clearly enough people were just kept bringing my name up to HR. And I had literally sent my resume in probably 7 to 10 times. I don't know. I mean, literally she called me. I remember her calling me and it was April. I was still at college. And she's like, oh, you haven't graduated yet. I said, no, I graduate in 4 weeks. And she's like, well, how soon can you be out here? And I was like, well, how soon do you need me? I was like, I can literally be out there right after I graduate. Like literally, like I'll graduate and move out there. And she's like, well, why don't we just say June 1st? Cause I graduated on like May 17th or something. Right. And I was like, okay. So I tell my parents this, I'm like, okay, I'm moving out to LA. And they were like, do you have a job? I was like, nope, but I'm just going to move out there. We're going to figure it out. And I luckily had three friends actually at the time, though two had only moved back, that were from LA that I met at NYU. So I had a place to I was couch diving and, you know, hanging with a couple of friends and at their parents' house, quite honestly, until I got a job, you know. And then William Morris offered a job and I tried to find an apartment that was super close because you got a walking stipend or, you know, I don't know if they still do that, but at the time they did. And I was like, okay, any way I can save money or get paid more. So I made it work. It's, you know, obviously you figure it out and I did. And I loved it. I mean, like I said, I'm glad I was there. I knew I didn't want to stay there like forever. LA wasn't probably going to be my long-term plan, but, it's somehow I got there and that's how it opened my eyes and the door to get to where I am now. So crazy.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening and hope you're enjoying the show. Some of you may know that I run an industry newsletter called the Nashville Briefing. It really takes you to the front row of everything happening in our industry. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com to subscribe. Also, if you're enjoying this show and specifically this episode, please feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform. Thanks so much. Now back to the show.
Okay, wait, so you're in LA, you're getting put on all these lists. You're like, wait a second, what is happening here? You travel out to Nashville, and then how do you actually make the move to Nashville?
So, yeah, so I came to Nashville to visit. Really fell in love with the city and just everything. Went back and said that to my current boss. And I was like, I feel like I need to be in Nashville. And he was like, okay, let's talk through how we can transfer. You're going to have to wait and see if there's a position, if they can transfer you. So that took a little bit of time, but I mean, maybe a month or so I was able to then transfer to a job opening in the Nashville office. I packed my little crappy car, which I didn't think was going to make it, and drove 40, you know, all the way from LA to Nashville in like 3 days. My poor sister, my little sister came out to make the drive with me and she had just had surgery on her feet. So she just had her feet propped up and I did the entire driving. And so we made the drive. I got here, showed up in the Nashville office and I got thrown on Greg Oswald's desk, who I don't know how well you know Greg, but at the time he was like, basically running the office and had a lot of clients. And I was like, I'm not sure this is a good idea. Like, I'm really new at this. I don't really know all the lingo. I don't know. And he had two assistants. So I was the second assistant, but you know, I'm glad that happened. It was like sink or swim. You just figure it out and you jump in and, you know, and I was with him for a couple years. And then I moved to another agent's desk for a little bit. And then I got promoted. And you start off as like a club agent. And that was, you know, a lot of fun. And you learn how to deal with, you know, everyone and in the club level, because you have buyers who are you know, running clubs, but also have other jobs or, you know, doing all type. And you're usually, I literally was calling them at like all hours of the night because they don't, you know, they don't work a 9-to-5 job. You know, they may work from 3 p.m. to 3 a.m. So then you have that short window to try to grab them and book shows, and you're chasing them down for deposits and contracts. And yeah, it was fun. And then you just keep working your way up. So from clubs to arenas to or theaters to colleges and arenas and, you know, kind of keep going.
Do you have a favorite type of room to see a show in? Is it club, arena, theater, stadium?
Ooh, that's a really good question. If I think back on my recent, because people like to ask, what are your favorite concerts? And it's always so hard because it changes, you know, because every year you see more concerts, except obviously this year. And so things start to replace my list. But like, I saw Lizzo at the Cannery, and like, hands down, that was one of my favorite shows. But then she came back and played the Ryman, and I saw her at the Ryman, and I was like, okay, I think that replaces the Cannery, just because of like, the energy in both of those venues being so different was so freaking energetic and exciting and like visceral, you know? But then, you know, Springsteen is still one of my favorite guys to see in an arena because he, you know, you feel like no matter where you are in that arena, he's singing to you. Bruno Mars, you know, I mean, I've only seen him in arenas and that's the same type of show. So and maybe it's more artist specific, but like, I do love seeing a good club show, especially when that artist is so good live and you know they're gonna blow up and it's like you were there, you know, like everyone loves
that's always amazing when you see an artist right on the verge of blowing and you're like, this is the last time we're ever gonna be in a club or a theater with this artist. That's always so good.
those are things you can't recreate, you know what I mean? So that's why I actually really appreciate the artists who are able to literally do every single type of show. You know, I mean, it happens, right? Where someone blows up and they skip over, you know, the club circuit or the theater circuit. But it's like, I just think it's important to you as an artist, but it's also really important to the fans to be able to grow with the artist. I mean, how fun is it to see someone from a Cannery to a Ryman to a headline Bonnaroo, you know, or whatever. So.
Totally. You can take fans with you for the journey. And then someone like you mentioned earlier, Dave Matthews, who's, you know, doing arenas, but every now and then I'll play Radio City with an acoustic guitar and Tim Reynolds and it's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm always an arena guy. Like, I think most of my favorite concert memories are in arenas or big amphitheaters. But then, like, Belly Up in the middle of Colorado is, like, one of my favorite clubs ever. And I've had some amazing experiences in that club, seeing some incredible acts. So, it's always good. It's always fun.
Totally. I mean, yeah, the Troubadour, right? Like, seeing shows out of the Troubadour are always, like, memorable. And I don't know. Yeah, like you said, there's a lot of great rooms, which... plug for Neva, and who's really trying to save all of our independent venues. I mean, it's really scary, and that's sad to me too, that there could be a lot of change because of this, right? I don't know how many venues we'll be able to pull through. So anyway, that could be depressing. So I don't want to.
So you're climbing the ranks at WME. What was the first artist that you signed?
So one of the first artists I signed was a regional act in, he was out of like the Illinois area. And honestly, I mean, like super great guy, talented artist, but just, it never clicked in Nashville for him. You know, he had worked with different publishers that no major label ever signed him, but I saw potential because he was selling out those clubs. That was my territory. I had the Midwest for a long time. And I could see that he was selling these small clubs out in Illinois and Indiana and whatever. And, but then it, you know, like I said, it never clicked nationally. And we worked together for a while. And then I just said, like, listen, I'm doing everything I can for you, but I don't see it growing past your kind of home states that you've built. So, you know, and it just may not work long term, much, much longer anyway. And so it was an amicable parting. And then I'd say probably the first act that I signed that became more of a national act, I signed Raylan the day after she got kicked off The Voice. it was the week after, but it was right after she got kicked off The Voice. She came on during Miranda's set at Stagecoach that year. And I went out there specifically because I knew she was going to be there. Her publisher at the time had kind of reached out to us and asked if we were interested. We were watching her on the show. I thought, you know, it was all about it and thought she was great. So went out to Stagecoach to meet her. She walked on stage with Miranda just during like her one song and to sing, and she had no fear. And it was like, oh my gosh, she was, you know, 17 years old at the time. I was like, she's got it. She's got something. So she, I mean, Raylan and I have been working together for a long, long time. Gosh, that was a long time ago. She's what, that was 8 years ago, maybe, or something like that. 6 years, seven, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? And just to see the evolution, and you know, obviously she's still doing a lot of cool things, and she just put out a new EP just a couple weeks ago. So excited.
I was gonna say, I feel like she's putting out her best music yet,
which is
a big statement. Absolutely. Yep. So you had mentioned in the Aiba podcast that when you first started, you know, agents were typically the last members coming to the team, and now they're more increasingly becoming the first members on the team.
Yeah.
Where does that transition happen, or why is that taking place now more often?
You know, I think it's because back then, like even when I first started, like I said, it was more like the artist was getting lined up with a label first, and like product had to come out. It was all those things, like you need to have product out, you need to get a song out to radio, and then we'll start the touring. But now obviously a lot of music's coming out even before, you know, not on a national label, right? You can come out, you can release music independently with all the different viral and you know, Spotify and DSPs. It's easier for an artist to kind of grow grassroots without having to have national airplay. So that's why I think it's kind of flipped, quite honestly. So we're like talking about signing someone regionally, like we're watching a lot of these artists who are regionally having a huge impact, you know, and they've put out music independently and they can sell out, you know, whatever the clubs or theaters are in their area, and have been building this home base. And so we jump on and see it quicker in the touring side, you know, than labels sometimes do, just because of that. We see it on the touring side. And I think touring has become so much more important, right? As revenue streams have changed for artists, the touring side of it has become more important. So jumping in earlier with artists has been more important. It's hard though. It's really hard to start growing something organically like that. You know, I mean, it takes an artist really, really, really like building it, you know, and that means from starting with a club that we maybe have 10 people there, and that includes the wait staff, to the next time you hope you have 15 people there. You know, I mean, some people have these thoughts of like, oh, it just doubles every time you go. And I'm like, no, it doesn't.
Trust me.
It doesn't. I remember booking Eric Church in one of the same clubs in Michigan, like a lot of times in a row. And it, you know, and it wasn't just doubling every time, right? It was like, okay, eventually you get to that point, but it's repetitiveness, right? And just building that connection with your fans, you know, when you have that, when you do have a solid touring base, your career will be longer than others, right? Like, you know, and this is no disrespect to some who've had like some quick success at radio and can skip those, what I was saying earlier, skip those steps. But it's like, once you've built that really solid touring base, they're not dependent on a radio song. They're dependent on you as an artist putting out good music. Which I think is exciting. You know, I think that's really great about what live music is. And even this whole pandemic has proven that people are still really wanting to have live music. I mean, the virtual shows, they're happening, but it's not actually changing the game for most people. You know, they want to see it. It's a community thing too. I mean, I think that's what's so interesting. Someone else said this to me, you know, the sporting events, you're there cheering on one team versus the other team, but a concert, you're all there cheering the same thing on, right? You're not pitted against the other team or pitted against the away fans or the home fans or whatever. You're all there to see that artist, and you're all there really cheering that they're going to sing that song to you, or you're going to sing that song together, and you're going to, you know. And I think that's what's so cool about live music is it's never going to go away because of that, you know?
Totally. I mean, I remember being in high school and going to see Dave Matthews every time he came around, and my friends and I would drive hours. We'd stay in, you know, one hotel room, five of us. We'd get there early. We'd barbecue. We'd hang out. We'd throw a Frisbee. And it's like, you know, he doesn't have to put out, you know, if he never had another record out ever again.
Yep.
Well, that same group of friends and I are going to be seeing Dave Matthews concerts for the rest of our life. Like,
yeah,
it's incredible.
Right. I know. I mean, I've been working with Rascal Flatts the last few years, and who I love, right? And it's like Rascal Flatts, you still go to hear their number one hits, right? Everyone does. And so it's like, and they'll be able to tour as long as they want, you know, obviously, because you're still going to go out and keep listening to the Rascal Flatts songs that, you know, and they're putting out new music still, obviously. But my point is to what you just said, like if you're a fan, you're a fan because you've grown up with them. You have songs that are reminiscent for you in your life. Like you heard that song and it reminds you of da da da. And you know, and so then, I mean, I remember Rascal Flatts. I have, you know, moments where I'm like, oh my gosh, I remember hearing that. And this is what phase I was in my life. And these are my friends, or, you know, this was a wedding song for my friends, whatever, right? All those moments. And so you go to the concert to relive those and to connect with that again.
So I know you're going to shoot this down, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Any words on the Rascal Flatts reunion?
Oh, I know. I wish I could give you a specific answer, but I don't have that yet. So stay tuned. Stay tuned.
How early will you get on board with an artist? If you find an artist in their bedroom that just knocks you out, and you just are, you know, if you can't, you know, will you get on board that early?
Yeah, I mean, here's what's so, yes and no. I mean, part of it is, like, I've definitely met with artists who I think there's something there. I can tell within just, like, who they are, their presence, their music, all of that. But then sometimes I have said, like, this is my opinion, right? Like, I think you need to go do this, X, Y, Z, before we get on board. And then sometimes they've already done all those things and they're ready to go, you know, and going back to like what I said earlier, like so there's gotta be a reason for them to really start to want to tour. And sometimes we jump in with an artist and we're like, hey, you don't need to go tour yet, but we can help you in all these other aspects, right? So maybe it's within our digital team working with them, or within, you know, they're trying to set up, you know, some more regional stuff, right? Maybe it's not even a national thing. It's like, hey, I'm just kind of working my home couple states, my one state and the couple states around it. And, you know, and we jump in and just try to help them on that situation. Or we're trying to connect them with the right publishers. I mean, there's definitely been artists that we've signed. Even with Ingrid, like I started with Ingrid and she wasn't out on the road. It was more about setting up things. And, you know, she had a publisher. That's how I met her, actually. Was through Missy Roberts at Universal. But we were then kind of working on like all these other things to kind of like set it up for her so that when the time came, then she was ready to go. So yeah, sometimes it's not just a touring thing that needs to come into play right away. It's all these other kind of connections and kind of stepping stones so that you're ready. We talk about planting seeds a lot. I mean, a lot of the times it's, you're talking about an artist way before they have any music out. And we're telling, you know, music promoter or promoters in other states, we're telling festival promoters, other managers, and so that when the time is ready, that everyone's been like, oh yeah, you were telling me about this artist for like a while now, you know, and they jump on board faster. So that education process is a big part of the development game too.
Absolutely. Okay, so you're climbing the ranks at WME, you're working with some, you know, the biggest acts on the roster, Reba, Trisha Yearwood, you know, Lanko, I mean, Sarah Evans, the list is insane. And then last year you become co-head of the Nashville office. How does your job actually change when you become co-head? Like, what extra responsibilities do you end up taking on with that title?
Well, that's a good question, because it's interesting. It was awesome, by the way, when that happened. I was extremely honored and humbled to be part of that leadership group. I mean, I've learned a ton from Jay Williams and Joey Lee and Scott Clayton and Greg Oswald. Before that, like I said, he's been a huge mentor of mine. So to kind of jump into that role has been huge. I mean, what changes is obviously, you know, I still am doing everything I need to do as an agent for those clients. But then there's, you know, administrative and managerial stuff that comes into play. So it's everything from, you know, office expenditures to, you know, anything from like HR issues to, but I mean, the big thing is strategy for our whole team. I feel like culture, like our WME, our biggest asset is our people, right? If our agents are empowered and feel like they have all the tools they need to be great agents, then we're going to succeed. So, you know, clients may come and go. For certainly, we don't ever want to lose clients, but like you don't want to lose your people. So that's kind of where I think my thought has flipped, where before I was like, okay, I'm doing my stuff for my clients, da, 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 and I still am, but now I'm thinking like, what's best for our WME team? And how do we make sure they feel supported, championed, you know, have the right tools, have the right resources, and let's all think strategically. I mean, that's what we've been doing obviously since March, is like as a group, come together. How do we there's a lot of smart people in our office. How do we all come together and what are innovative ways to pivot? What are you seeing, you know, working in your territory, or what are your clients doing, and how do we come up with new ideas to engage fans? And so that's, I think, probably the added role, if you will, when you, and I've gotten that title, but you know, I love that. I love that part of it. I'm always a person that's like, what can we do to make our team stronger? So I'm a team player, and I never did good in individual sports anyway. So
absolutely. So, and I'm also curious, how'd you come up with Talk the Talk, and are you guys still finding ways to hop on Zoom during the pandemic? Are you still able to keep that going during this time?
Yeah. You know, I knew you were going to ask that. So Talk the Talk started because I was inspired by Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, right? When I first got promoted as an agent, there were only like 3 female agents. And it just felt like, I mean, and there was a lot of females at the time even that would be like, oh, you know, whether they were an assistant or a younger level, and then they would end up leaving. They wouldn't stick it out. I mean, I don't really want to be an agent. I don't want to have to do all that. I don't have time. I don't want to balance it. And I was like, gosh, there's a way to do it. You know, there's totally a way to do it. And so I just felt Talk the Talk needed to happen to kind of encourage the women to feel like, one, we can support each other and to use each other to really keep, you know, building the long-term journey, if you will, in this career and in this industry. And so I've been really proud of that. And, you know, and there's a lot of women in our office. We now have, you know, over, I think, 12 female agents in the office just in Nashville, as far as the country division, which is exciting. So we've definitely grown, and it's just a way for all of us to come together and really feel heard and be able to support each other. It's funny you say that, because we just haven't been focusing on that, quite honestly, because there's been some other priorities to focus on.
Totally.
But we've been talking about doing something in the fall, because we usually do a women's retreat, actually, and we weren't able, we had one that we were planning for July. Obviously that wasn't going to happen. So it's like, okay, well, let's do something instead in the fall to come together and then get back on track with some talk the talk stuff. But yeah, it's kind of been paused slightly just because of everything that's been going on. And we've had some other kind of other fires to attend to first.
Of course. I'll end with this. You know, obviously, like, you know, we were alluding to, it's such a hard time for the industry right now, and, you know, beyond the industry, of course, but I'm just curious, what has you optimistic in this moment?
You know, I, like I said, I go back to just the fact that, like, live music is irreplaceable. You know, it really is. Like, people are really wanting and still connect with music when it's live. So I have no doubt that it's going to come back. I can't tell you exactly when it's going to come back. I do feel optimistic that it's going to come back sooner than everyone's maybe thinking. But it's still probably April, May, June, you know, maybe at the earliest, right? In large gatherings. And I feel like literally we just got a report from some of our analytic team, you know, within the office about, you know, I mean, streaming's still, I mean, you know, music itself.
Streaming's up. BMI just had like the biggest year ever. It's crazy.
Exactly. So all of those indicators are showing that, like, music's not going away, obviously. And I don't think live music is going to go away. I mean, I think that's going to be a huge part of it. So it's going to come back. It's just hard because it's, you know, we're all trying to figure out how long we have to wait. And then in the meantime, what can you be doing to stay afloat? So, you know, once I said, I feel optimistic because I know I have a great bunch of colleagues and that I've consider family and friends, and they're able to, like, we're all coming up with great ideas. Some of them are working, some of them don't work. That's okay. You know, throw out all of the ideas. We've got to just kind of see what works and sticks right now. Cause it's, you know, I mean, you saw it too. There was like a ton of different virtual shows in the first couple months. And then that seems to have faded away a little bit or evolved in certain ways where fans actually care and tune in, but you know, you just keep evolving, and that's kind of what we have to do. So people are wearing face masks more than they were. So I think if you tell people what they need to do. Yeah. Well, if you tell people what they need to do to go see a live show, I think a lot of them are going to go do that. There may be some that don't, and there's some that shouldn't, right? That have other health issues that probably shouldn't. But I think the majority of music lovers are going to be like, okay, if this is what it takes, these are the steps I have to take, whether it's a saliva test, whether it's a mask, whether it's, you know, whatever, to go see this live show, and they're a big fan of that artist, I think they will. I really hope so.
I'm driving this weekend 2.5 hours to Massachusetts. I'm in New York right now to see a production of Godspell in a tent outdoors.
I just listened to that podcast on the
Daily.
Yes. Oh, I can't wait. Fill me in on how it is.
I will. So, but like now I'm like, I probably never would have done that otherwise, but now right. It's like the whole family's going, it's going to be a family affair.
That's awesome. Oh my gosh. That's so funny. I literally would just listen to that podcast.
It was a great episode. We had tickets before that. And then I listened to the podcast and I got really excited for it. I was like, it was a little dramatic at times, but I was like, it's going to be so good. It's whatever. It'll probably be the highlight of the year.
Yeah. See?
Entertainment wise.
But like case in point, it's like, if I know there's a lot of, you know, conversations about disposable income and cash and, you know, how strapped people are. So, and I don't take that for granted. I think that is going to be one of our challenges is, you know, is ticket pricing need to change? I mean, merch numbers will probably change. I mean, there's going to be a lot of things like that, that will be a different economic, you know, impact on touring. But I don't think the desire to go see live shows is going to diminish. I don't, you know, I just think that's, thankfully, I don't think you can replace it. And I think people still want that. And especially in a trying year and a hard year where you want that connection, you know?
Absolutely. So when we are back in the arenas and we have that full year of shows, who's the artist or artists to watch out for because they're going to take over?
Ooh. I mean, Morgan
of course,
Hall.
Ingrid Andress and Tenille Townes and all.
Yes. Well, as I was saying, I mean, obviously the ones that are clearly taking off right now. I mean, Morgan Wallen's having huge success and it's exciting to see what he's doing. And I'm, you know, I'm loving Austin Neal as his agent. And I say that to Austin all the time, like freaking awesome what he's doing. I'm personally really excited, and this is biased because this is one of my clients, but like Jordan Davis is one to watch. I think he's everyone, you know, he's had some radio success, but like you need to see him live because he is a great live artist that people may or may not quite know of yet, and they will soon. So like I keep watching him because I think he's got new music that's coming that's going to be a huge, you know, I think turning point for him too. I'm excited about that. But like, gosh, Ashley McBride, I mean, there's so many great females, Gabby Barrett. We're really excited about a lot of the females that we have on our roster right now. And then, you know, the diversity, I mean, that's a big thing right now, obviously, that we're all really focusing on, but like Shai Carter is an awesome artist to be watching. We're working with, Tierra, who's a new artist, and she, has a radio, show on Apple right now, on Apple Country Radio, which we're excited about. So I just think there's a lot of great new artists coming. And I think with the talking about the development stuff and the way you can now reach your fans, I'm excited that there's going to be a lot more opportunities for those types of artists to have outreach and to be able to engage in with their fans. So, you know, stay tuned. Let's kind of keep watching where they all go, but we're excited about all of them.
Absolutely. Becky, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I appreciate you reaching out. I was flattered and humbled, and I was like, okay, cool. But I love reading. I do read your newsletter religiously. So I think
you
do a great
job.
Thank
you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you
it's
so
awesome.
Much. I appreciate it.
I love the articles. I'm a nerd like that. So I love all your articles at the end too. Cause I'm like, oh, I missed that one. Or I didn't, you know, I saw the headline.
That's the thing that most people say, which I think is interesting. Cause I always put it at the bottom and most people say that that's what they look at the most. So I'm like, maybe I should move that section. I don't know, but I appreciate it.
The other stuff is really good. Don't get me wrong. But that's what I like when I get to the bottom. I'm like, okay, here's the articles I need to like.
What have I missed? Sure
Yeah. No. I think it's great. So congrats. Fantastic.
Thank you so much. Well, I can't wait till we're back in Nashville or I'm back in Nashville. And I feel like I'm always out at shows and I always see my friends who work at WME and I miss all of them. I can't wait till we're back in the room and
me
say,
too.
Say hi to everyone.
I'm eager to be at a live show. So we'll hope to see you soon then.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Stay well.
You too. Thank you, Zach.
Talk to you soon. Thanks again for tuning in, and thanks again to Becky for taking the time to talk with us. Great conversation. Hope we get the chance to do it again soon. By the way, if you're wondering, Godspell was amazing. Just thought I'd let you all know. Okay. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at nashvillebriefing.com, or you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye.